Thank you. You may be seated. And good morning to everyone. We will begin with introductions from the court. I'm Mike Havokin, the Chief Justice, and now by order of seniority as to service on the court, the other members of the court will introduce themselves.
Good morning. I'm Lindsay Miller Lerman.
William Castle, good morning.
Stephanie Stacy, good morning.
Good morning, Jeff Funk.
Jonathan Pappick, good morning.
And John Freidenberg.
Thank you, members of the court, counsel, and other folks here. We appreciate your wearing masks while you are not presenting to the court. And when you are presenting, please take your mask off so that we can hear and understand what you have to say. Our first case of the morning is Millard Gutter Company versus Farm Bureau Property and Casualty Insurance Company. This is a petition for further review. So, Mr. Gibbons. I'm sure, Mr. Walden. I'm sorry. Apologize for that. You may approach and you may proceed.
Your Honors, may it please the court. My name is Ray Walden, for the defendant and petitioner on further review, Farm Bureau. This, of course, is paired with another case right behind it, and a common factor in it is first-party insurance bad faith, which in the Court of Appeals in this particular case, the Farm Bureau case, decided was adequately pled, although the district judge decided it was not adequately pled. This is a very important thing to have determined at the Supreme Court level, because it is used, especially in these roofing and insurance kinds of cases, to get at, just to make a total nuisance of the, or cause a nuisance for the insurance company. We're going to get into all of your files and everything else because we've attached the label bad faith to a contract claim. But that's not what, and of course discovery will follow along all those lines before we can get into what the case is really, you know, has no merit. But the in Brosh, when this court created the bad faith claim as a tort separate from the contract claim, it included, I call it consequent loss, the court called it a resulting direct loss from the non-payment. So contract case, you didn't pay enough, you know, as much as the other side wants. That's the contract case. Why is there a bad faith tort case as well? It's because in those early cases, and the reason that it was created was there was something else that happened because of the non-payment, like in Brosh, you know, they just wouldn't pay. On a UIM case, they had to go try the case. Emotional distress of the parents in having to try that case was that consequent loss. Followed very quickly by the Rue case, which was damage to farm building, and the court said an economic loss like that counts as a consequent loss. A resulting direct loss that gets you into the bad faith category, and what the loss was there was you know, this farm operation had a borrowing business that was destroyed or you know, harmed, you know, greatly because the insurance company wouldn't pay for the damage, you know, to fix the buildings. So where does that put us here? There is no allegations about bad faith. except the word bad faith comes up in this particular case once. And even in that context, they're still talking about bad faith because the roofer has been deprived of benefits owed, including prompt payment. Well, no, there's no consequent loss there. There's just non-payment. But really, we also have to go back because this is also an assignment.
How much detail or what would have to be in a document for you to think that there was adequate bad faith alleged and you could respond to it?
Well, certainly more than, you know, saying several different times that they weren't paid the money under the insurance policy and then calling that bad faith. I think there needs to be some kind of facts pled that, you know, would show that there was a, not just non-payment, but a consequent loss. But more particularly in an assignment kind of a case, it's not the non-payment of the assignee, the contractor who took the assignment. It's bad faith with respect to the assignor, the homeowner, the insured who gave the assignment. Was there bad faith existing at that time when they made that assignment? Because you can only assign the claim that you have. And they're just, you know, they come in and they say, oh, well, we took this assignment. And in fact, they didn't even tell us who any of the, you know, originally, you know, who anybody was.
Is the bad faith claim assignable? You know,
in this kind of a context, no, I don't believe so.
I mean, even if they pled bad faith, I mean, is it assignable?
You would have to assign, particularly spell out that there is a, whether you call it a tort in the thing or somehow make it clear that there is an assignment that is being made of an existing claim that constitutes the bad faith. I don't think if you, you know, you just say, oh, we're assigning our insurance claim on this.
It seems to be the bad faith claim is a result of non-payment of the claim. Is that correct?
That's the start of it, but that's the contract claim. The bad faith claim has to be also some direct loss caused.
So the bad faith, claim, did that occur before or after the assignment?
It has to occur before the assignment for there to be a bad faith claim that you can assign.
So you're talking now about standing.
Yes.
Was the Court of Appeals correct to sort of step over the question of standing and go to whether the amended complaint sufficiently alleged facts to state bad faith, or should standing be addressed as a jurisdictional matter first?
I think the first thing is you have to address standing as a jurisdictional matter. And when you're looking at the complaint itself, there was not even the vaguest notion of standing existing because they didn't identify anybody, any claims, nothing.
So the amended complaint alleges with respect to the assignment that the policyholders, quote, assigned their right to any proceeds under policies. What does that tell us about the scope of the assignment in this case? Can we tell whether it was an assignment of proceeds, an assignment of all rights and interests under a policy? What do we know about that? And what impact does that have on standing?
Well, we just know what they put in their amended complaint. They finally said who the people are. But then they said that, well, there are assignments at various times, but the allegations all have to do with the proceeds, the benefits. We didn't get paid the benefits.
Can a policyholder assign the right to proceeds under a policy and not assign the right to prosecute an action to recover those proceeds?
Absolutely. You can assign just, you know, whatever piece of a claim that you have against somebody else. And when you say we don't have the assignments, you know, you've had the Valley Boy, you know, one of the Valley Boy cases, they at least would attach the assignments so we kind of know what we're dealing with.
And we know the language in the Valley Boy cases, that it assigned all the rights and interests under the policy.
Right. Here we have the allegations about what the assignments were, and there is only in terms of the policy proceeds. So I don't think, you know, we get past the standing problem to get to, okay, let's have discovery and find out what those assignments actually say, because they can go ahead and allege in more detail what they are. They chose not to do that.
I beg your pardon. Justice Miller-Lerman here. What do you believe the state of the law is? If you could synthesize Valley Boys and the 2018 statute and so forth, where do you think we're at and what do you seek?
Well, the statute has to do with requirements for standing, for assignments after the effective date of that. And this was 2013 storm. All the assignments were within 2013. And then they come in with the amended complaint that is more than not, it's not just the 5 years of the original complaint. It's the amended complaint was almost 6 years down the line. And so it was completely justified in saying, well, you need to now allege what it was that was the breach, or at least when the breaches were. So we can't form a like statute of limitations or anticipate a relation back argument with respect to the.
Why is relation back an issue in this case at all? The parties weren't changed in the amended complaint.
Assignment, they say they had assignments and they absolutely said nothing about who they were until the amended complaint, which was 5 years, 11 months after the storm. And meanwhile, they finally, they say, and we had assignments from all these people from various times within a few months after that storm, about within 6 months. Well, there's still more time to go. And, well, first of all, you have a 5-year statute on contract, you have a 4-year statute on torts, and we're almost 6 years down the line when they're finally alleging something that could be jurisdictional.
Has this court ever made a decision or analyzed whether the statute of limitations for a first party bad faith claim is governed by the 4-year tort statute of limitations or the 5-year contract statute of limitations or the 1-year intentional tort statute of limitations?
I have not seen any such thing. I believe it's the 4-year tort. It may be an intentional tort, but it's not the kinds of intentional torts that I believe are covered by that statute. But even with the 4 years, we have to be able to formulate our response, and that's what the district court was getting at. You need to allege those things so that the insurance company can make a an intelligent response, and that's the purpose of the definite and certain.
Counsel, do you contend that what you're suggesting should have been pleaded was required to be pleaded under Nebraska Court Rule of Pleading 6-1109A, dealing with capacity?
I have not thought of it in terms of capacity. Standing, which is, I believe, 12B2, and failure to state a claim under 12C, B6. I'm sorry, I can't on the spot think of what capacity has to do with it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Becker, good morning to you.
May it please the court, Miller Gutter respectfully submits that the Court of Appeals was correct in its decision that it was premature to dismiss this complaint because a cognizable complaint was stated based upon the allegations. If you look to this case, this court's decision in Tryon, to quote from it, which I'm sure you're familiar with, a party is only required to set forth a short and plain statement of the claim showing that the pleader is entitled to relief. The party is not required to plead legal theories or cite appropriate statutes so long as the pleading gives fair notice of the claims asserted. Tyron goes on to say that you shouldn't dismiss these cases that may be developed through the course of discovery.
Counsel, I want to ask you the same question I asked your opponent. And that is, do you think that Nebraska Court Rule of Pleading 6-1109A has any application to this question?
I do not believe so, and because it was never raised in the courts below. or raised as an assignment of error to challenge either to challenge the court appeals decision. But moreover, our pleadings state that we forwarded to the insurance company an assignment of the rights under the policy.
Rights to any proceeds under policies. That's what's alleged. Is that important to our analysis?
It says actually paragraph 5, assignment of rights under the policies, including the right to proceeds. And I respectfully submit, because I've done this contract myself, when I'm in this position of the insured and I want to give my contractor the ability to go after the insurance company to fight them with every arrow they might possibly have in the quiver, I've sat there and told the adjuster, I've assigned my claim to the contractor. Don't talk to me. Don't try to negotiate with me. You negotiate with them. You deal with them because I'm not the expert. And that is what insurers do time after time after time, because otherwise they don't have the economic capability to fight the insurance companies. I've had insurers call me and say, you know, they're not approving the gutters, or they're not approving the decking, or they're not giving me ice and water shield. And these elements end up being $3,000 and $4,000, and no layperson can battle the insurance company or wants to invest the time, money, and effort or capital to go fight the insurance company.
Would what you it agree takes with is a me contract. That a policyholder can assign the rights to proceeds under a policy without also assigning the right to control the action or prosecute the action to recover the proceeds?
That's a question of intent between the parties.
Yes or no?
The part they could assign the proceeds.
That's a yes.
They could assign the proceeds. Okay. Yes. Fine. But they could also assign every right that they have under the policy. In this earlier case, Miller Gutter versus Farm Bureau, the language that you utilized was they assign the claim. When we've had insureds in depositions or give affidavits, they say, I signed my claim to the contractor. It's up to them to go pursue the insurance company.
I'm sorry to interrupt. How can we tell from the language, the allegations of the amended complaint, whether the entire chosen action was assigned or whether the rights to proceeds were assigned?
We aver in paragraph 5 that there is an assignment of the rights under the policies, including, but not limited to, the right to proceeds. That question that you're raising is an issue that needs to be developed, because the application of the Trion case suggests that we've alleged sufficient notice of the claim. We're saying we stand in the shoes of the insured. That's also pled that we stand in the shoes of the insured, and they're depriving us these benefits because they have a continuing obligation to negotiate and pay this claim under statute in good faith. And what they do, because there's a whole supplemental process, they'll deny elements of a claim. They may pay for part of a roof, but they'll deny the decking. They'll deny ice and water shield. You
Counsel,
need to have someone
standing,
have the ability to force that.
If standing is raised at the pleading stage, right, what is your responsibility as the plaintiff's lawyer to allege facts or to show and from the four corners of the amended complaint that you have standing to bring the claims that are alleged in the complaint?
We've averred sufficient allegations to suggest that we do have standing.
And that's been challenged.
All they said was 12B6 in the motion to dismiss. They said you failed to state a claim. They didn't even challenge, in terms of standing, the contractual remedy.
Was the trial court's dismissal based on standing?
With respect to bad faith, the court made that determination, but didn't make that determination with respect to the contract. And our position is, with respect to the issue of standing, you're really getting into items of factual determination. The intent of the party making the assignment, the insured customer, which can be developed through the course of discovery, where they can explain, this is what the contractor told me, this was my agreement, I intended to assign all rights to the contractor. It is not something necessary to plead at the initial pleading stage. Either Trion stands for the proposition that all you're required to do is give a short and plain statement, or it doesn't. There's no special requirement simply because we are pursuing an insurance company every day. Every single day in county
courts. But you are pursuing a claim that belonged to someone else, and you're filing the lawsuit premised only on an assignment. And so I'm focusing on the scope of that assignment and what we know from the amended complaint.
Every day in county courts throughout the state, collection companies, for credit cards, for hospitals, file bare bone pleadings to say, we stand in the shoes of an assignor. Sometimes they don't even name it. We say, we've been assigned the rights to pursue recovery. There's typically 3 and 4 paragraph complaints on medical bills involving hundreds of thousands of dollars. No one in county court requires those people to give the details of the assignment, the consideration given for the assignment, the date of the assignment, to attach the assignment. What happens day in and day out is that there's the pleading that they have been assigned the rights. That same pleading.
Where do you show, where, what allegation in this complaint purports to suggest that Millard Gutter has the right to collect in this case, and not just the right to receive proceeds?
We've been assigned the rights under the policies, including the right to proceeds. Necessarily, the right to proceeds would carry with it the ability to collect. And again, if that is a defense they wish to develop and say, well, the insured didn't really intend to give you the right to collect, which would be something developed factually, that is something for the process of discovery, not at the pleading stage, which simply requires a short and plain statement of the relief sought. We say we stood in the shoes of these customers. We perform the work in consideration for the assignment of the rights under the policy and those proceeds. We did the work. The insurance company refused to communicate with us. They refused to make prompt payment. They refused to pay what they rightfully owed under the policies. That states a cognizable, plausible claim for relief. They may develop defenses to it, but the question under the standard is whether or not we've made an intelligible pleading and whether or not it's a cognizable claim that may be developed through the course of discovery. And I respectfully submit that these can and are have been demonstrated to be developed through the course of discovery.
Let me ask this a different way. Suppose you have a claim for fraud, and you are relying in this case on 6-1108, which specifies the contents of a complaint and refers to a short statement. But 6-1109B, in my hypothetical, requires that averments of fraud, the circumstances constituting the fraud, shall be stated with particularity. And are you suggesting that in a fraud case, all you have to do is take a short statement of the facts without complying with 6-1109B?
No, we're not. But there are hundreds of cases, as the court is well aware of, that say fraud must be pled with particularity. This is not a case where we're alleging fraud. We're alleging they breached their continuing duties to make prompt payment, which is established under the act. There's an act that governs how insurance companies act when they've been given a claim. And that includes a continuing duty to act in good faith and make prompt payment of the claims and to have standards for investigation and to respond with reasonable promptness to communication, which we aver didn't occur. We stand in the shoes of the insured homeowner.
Are you going to let me ask the question, or do you want to just continue?
I was trying to finish my answer. I apologize.
To whom is the statutory duty to which you refer owed?
The party that stands in the shoes of the insured. The insured has the right to make an assignment of any right, claim, or interest it has under that policy. The court's already said in the first Farm Bureau case that insureds can assign claims. That the court recognized that's typically how these claims work, is that homeowners assign the claim. Necessarily with that is the right to go hold the insurance company accountable. That's why insureds do it. They don't want to be bothered with the time, expense, or burden. And to get into the minutia of whether or not that was the intent, or whether or not they may develop a defense and say, well, that's not really the understanding of the insured, that's something established through the discovery process. I submit that the Court of Appeals had it correct, that at the pleading stage, this claim, this complaint stated a cognizable claim upon which relief may be granted, which we should have been allowed to develop through the course of discovery.
Thank you very much, Mr. Becker. And do we have any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal, so we will go on to the next case of the day, which is Miller Gutter Company versus Shelter Mutual Insurance Company,